Session number 10295, Reel 1.
Mr. Lane, Reel 1. Can you tell me whereabouts you were born, Mr. Lane?
I was born here in Stockport.
Which year was that?
In 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
First he was a blacksmith, then he became a soldier with the Cheshires and the Worcesters. And then, due to gas during the war, he was released from the army in 1920 without a pension. And he suffered then until 1934 when he died of poison from the gas. I believe it was mustard gas, I'm not sure. But he was the one who told me never ever join the army, never volunteer. And because of him being so emphatic, you know, wanting me to stay away, I decided there's something there missing, so I'll go and have a look what it is. And I ran away from home. I told them I was 18. But
how old were you?
15 and a half. But they wouldn't have me. I was too small, they said. And then I left it for about a week and went back again. I'd heard somewhere that you could join as a boy soldier, so I enlisted as a boy soldier in the Manchester Regiment. The coincidence is that the sergeant who signed me on was named Lane, and the major who swore me in was Major Lane. Never ever seen either of them since, but, you know, just a coincidence. And I was sent direct with three other boys up to Strensel. We were never ever in the squaddies, in the depot or anything like that. We went straight into the regiment. We were signed on for the 1st Battalion, the Manchester Regiment. But we actually stayed with the 2nd Battalion from May 36 to January 37. And then in January 37, that's when life started getting a bit hectic. That's when we moved over to Egypt.
What was your initial training like in the army?
With no training. Boy soldiers don't get training. All you do is learn to play a bugle, a drum, a musical instrument, whatever. More or less, you were left to your own devices. This was the problem with it. But they were good lads, and there was very, very rare any mischief at all amongst the boys. The lads on boy service, up to 18 years of age, they very rarely got into any mischief. We had some brilliant lads. You know, brilliant, I mean, as regards sportsmen. Blackhurst, for one, he was a battalion goalkeeper. Lou Ode, he was another one, a right-wing footballer. There were some really clever lads. And then in athletics, we had good ones. The boxing team, I believe it was the top of Northern Command at the time. But I personally never ever did any boxing until later.
What did you think of the discipline to which the boys were subjected to in the army? Was it fair?
No, there was no discipline. We were taught stick drill. We used to in those days, you got a stick measured 18 inches with a silver handle. Every soldier got one, not just boys. And where the other lads were on the Barrack Square, sloping arms and presenting arms, we used to walk around smartly with this stick, pretending to take messages from one officer to another. You had to slam yourself to attention, bring the stick under your left arm, and present him with an imaginary message. Then he'd give an imaginary reply, which you transferred to your left hand, took your stick with your right hand, turned round smartly, and smartly walked away to the other officer. And that was the top training that we ever got. But apart from that, we were left to our own devices, as I say. I was in the drums. It was something I always wanted to be. I wanted to blow a bugle. Don't know why, it's just, I'd probably seen it on the films or something, you know. But that's what I wanted to be, and that's what I became. I was top bugler at one time. I buried, in my lifetime, I believe the last post over to 3,000 men altogether. Possibly a few odd ones after that. But regards to discipline, none at all. No discipline. Not until we got to Egypt.
What happened there?
In Egypt, it was considered a boy was still a boy until he was 18. So therefore, he couldn't stay out of barracks after 8 o'clock. Unless he had a special pass. you did get rigorous training then. You was placed in a barrack room, which we call the boys' room. There's two NCOs, one at each end. And whatever you did, they subjected you to discipline. You had to march smartly. When you went for your dinner, you couldn't amble, same as the men. You had to march for your dinner. Not necessarily in a line, but individually. But you had to swing your arms and, you know, and they did their utmost, some NCOs. Corporal Jones was about the best. He used to really lay about the lads. Nothing nasty, but making sure he tried to make men out of it. You know.
So he wasn't resented?
Oh, no, no, no. No, we never resented it. I mean, he was trying to teach us something that we wanted to be, you know. And the four lads that I joined with, well, three other than myself, there's only me left. The other three lads died at various stages, or were killed at various stages. In Egypt, the battalion itself was it was a friendly battalion. I knew practically every man by his name. And there was 980 of us. I knew every man and officer by his name. And I could, you know, walk down the barrack square or around the barracks or anything. I'd spot a man, I'd know straight away, that's so-and-so. And it was the same with all the boys. That was all we had to do, was to memorise all the time. But I think it was that that's given me a good memory, actually. I can remember incidents that happened, well, years and years ago. I remember the first incident when I was a kid. I was 3 years old singing Bumfire Night, Stars Are Bright. And what was happening was my mother was on fire upstairs and my brother was trying to roll her down the stairs in a carpet. And that's my first memory, you know, when I was three. So since then, you know, memory has developed on different things, you know, I've made it. I can remember incidents in Strength Hall. King Clark, who you just mentioned. King Clark had all his kit stolen by his batman. And that was about a month to 6 weeks before we left for Egypt. When we left for Egypt, all the lads had to go by train and boat and whatnot down to Egypt. King Clark, he had his own plane, a little red plane. And he flew on either before us or he came on afterwards. And in Egypt, I don't know what he wrote in his book, but we very rarely saw him in Egypt. Not that he was out nightclubbing or anything like that. There was nothing like that. I think he was possibly going out to schools or training or something, but we very rarely saw him in Egypt. It was only in Palestine where we actually met up with him again. As a matter of fact, we even thought he'd left the army.
What kind of duties did you have in Egypt?
In Egypt, I was a bugler. The boys had to do guard duty, which entailed sounding all the calls of the day. You know, company, orderly corporal, orderly sergeant, orderly officer, mail call, sick call. You had to memorise all these calls. And that was your job each day to do that. The other duties we had was the band and drums always beat retreat once a month. We had the coronation parade, King's birthday parade, different things like that. Incidentally, did you know that the Manchester Regiment was the first airborne unit in the British Army?
No.
In 1937, they brought a plane along. I'm not sure whether it was coronation or King's birthday, what it was. One of these parades, anyway. They banged 36 of the men into a plane with the full gear, plus their suitcases, etc. And they all they did was put them into a plane, taxied the plane round, and then brought it around to where the parade was taking place for the men to march off and the newspapers to take photographs of what could be the use of airplanes in those days. You know, this was the future.
But you were one of those?
Oh, no, no. I was one of those that took photographs. But there was about 36 on the plane.
What were relations like with the Egyptians in those days? Did you see anything of them?
Yeah, we knew most of the lads that came into the camp. We called them wogs. And people say it's racial and all this. It's a load of bull. The wogs didn't mind what you call them. They call you similar names anyway. He didn't know what they was talking about. No, with the Egyptians, they were all right. We weren't allowed to mix. We weren't allowed to socialise. But the amusing thing was in Egypt that if you had money, we was allowed, we was paid a shilling a day. And then we being overseas, they allowed us another eightpence a week. But the men themselves, they got a higher rate of pay than we did on board service. So that it was impossible for you to go out and spend any money in town. You hadn't got the money to spend. But occasionally we'd go out and go down to the Bitter Lakes where there was swimming, boating, and it was all service material. You didn't have to pay for it. And on the way there, one particular day, I was with a lad called Eddie Ludbrook from Bolton. And while we was having a glass of, then it was iced orange. You got the ice in with the orange drink. And we sat at the side of a so-called cafe. And the bloke came over and asked us if we'd deliver a letter for him to the Bitter Lakes. And being naive and youngsters, we agreed. And he said he'd give us 10 piastres, which was 100 mils, which was equivalent to from about 2 and 6. Well, you could post a letter for 2.5 mils, you know, and we scratched our little bonnets and thought, well, you know, there must be something daft. Anyway, we agreed to take it, and we took it to a cafe at the Bitter Lakes and handed it over to another man, I forget his name, let's say Abdul, something like that. And he gave us a further 10 piastres, which was 20 piastres, which is 5 shillings for nothing. It's more than we earned in a week. So we mentioned it, I mentioned it when we got back to one of the lads. And he said, do you know who he was? You know, I said, no. And for several days, when we went out, we took this guy with us, until eventually, after 3 or 4 weeks, we bumped into the same fella. And of course, he knew, was a big surprised look on his face, and he came over and asked us if we'd repeat the procedure. So I said, well, we're not going, but my friend will. So he said, oh, thank you, you know, and we introduced him, and Amby, he picked the letter up. And we buzzed off, walked down to Bitter Lakes, about 2 mile, 3 mile away. And on the way there, of course, Andy starts opening it. And being well-disciplined lads, we said, you shouldn't do that, that's mail, it's private, you know. But no, he opened it up, and inside this poor, what do you call it, greaseproof, piece of greaseproof paper. And in each was a white compound. And Andy said, that's what it is, it's bloody ashes. You know, so he put it back in and sealed it. And went down to the cafe at the Bitter Lakes and handed it over. And when he came out, he gave us 10 piastres each, me and Eddie. And he got 30 for himself. And after that, he used to do the run. We was carrying drugs. And so much so that if you was affluent there, if you had money, you rode a bicycle. And Andy had a bicycle, a brand new one. And everybody wondered where he got it from, you know, but... they never found out.
Why were they using soldiers to do it?
Apparently, the bloke that we was dealing with wasn't an Arab. He was an ex-legionnaire. He was a deserter from the Foreign Legion. And he got himself a nice business going. And he got a pusher over in on the Bitter Lakes. And we was doing his carrying for him. But nothing ever came, but, you know, we was never, ever found out.
Now, can you tell me about how you came to go to Palestine for the period of the Arab revolt there, please?
Well, around about the end of 1937, the Munster Regiment became mechanised. And they also became a machine gun regiment in their own right. Before that, there was just an ordinary infantry regiment. And I don't know whether it's the powers that be or what, but it seems to me very coincidental that we suddenly are supplied with the vehicles and machine guns and automatics and trench mortars, 4-inch mortars. And then it was one, round about Christmas, yeah, Christmas 1937. The officers always, they come down and serve the men on Christmas Day with the dinner. And... somehow or other, one of them got drunk. I don't know who it was, but he happened to mention that we'd possibly be going into action within the next few days. And of course, it was a general buzz all the way around. I don't know who the officer was, but he got sent back to England. And that was the first warning we had that we were going to Palestine. And we had 4 weeks to prepare, which meant chaps who were learning to drive had to do night driving. They had to learn it within 4 weeks. Machine gunners had to become accurate within 4 weeks. They were taken out onto the big flea and the little flea, doing their actions over there.
Big flea and little flea?
Any squad who knows the big flea and little flea. That's in, what do you call it, in Egypt, over on the desert. It was two whacking great hills. And it was similar or typical of the type of terrain that we were going into, where ambush would take place. And for 4 weeks, the battalion were flogged. They were drilled incessantly into jumping on trucks, jumping off trucks. And then, I don't know if it was one of our battalion, but someone invented a system whereby you got a drain pipe in the back of a 15-weight truck, and it was bolted to the base of the truck. There was just a drain pipe that came up with an open top, and the machine gun was fitted with a piston type of thing. And all he did was just jump and ram your machine gun on top of this drain, and you got a mobile machine gun that could go to any angle. You could twist it and turn it all over the place. So we went into Palestine, you know, with that. The drivers, they drove through. The remainder of the battalion, we got a train from Mawaska. That was our army camp. And from there, I think it took us about 24 hours altogether by train. Various junctions and twist-offs. And we entered Palestine down by Alcantara. From Alcantara, the battalion split up. Three companies went to Safad, Salafand, and Mailia. Those were outposts.
Safad, Salafand, and what?
Mailia. I spell it Mielia. Mailia. We're only little villages. And we went on to Tiberias. That was HQ Company, the band and drums, and DS Company. Well, DS Company had been a machine gun company within the regiment. And they were also in charge of the mules and the transport, you know, the donkeys and such. In Tiberias, I was billeted at the Central Hotel, where it was just a small hotel. It housed, I would imagine, about 100 of us. Of the 100, 12 were boys on boy service. Most of them were nearing the age where they were going into to become duty men anyway. And the company itself was stationed at the Elizabethan Hotel, which was roughly 500 yards up a dirt track. And the HQ was up there. So that each day, when we wanted a meal, we had to get out of bed, parade, and march up this dirt track to the Elizabethan Hotel, have our meal, and then come down and back down to the Central Hotel to do whatever we was doing. That was in the first few days, and then after that, everything relaxed, and you could go up and down for your meal whenever you wanted. The luxury in those days was a pat of butter every night. You got I don't know what it had been weight. It was equal to about a teaspoonful, but that was the luxury of the day. And all around us, we'd got grapefruits, jaffas, you know, but they weren't luxuries as far as we were concerned. This butter, and everybody prayed for their evening meal so they could get a pat of butter. It really tasted nice. But in Palestine, that's where, or I should say in Tiberias, that's where I first had my bloodbath, initiation.
Yeah, what?
Initiation. I'd gone down with one of the lads down to the Sea of Galilee. The routine was still the same. All lads, all boys had to be back in for 8 o'clock. Unless it was accompanied by seniors or they had a pass. And we'd been down on the Sea of Galilee, which was, to me, it was absolutely marvellous. It's something I'd never seen before. And we were so involved in what we were doing, we forgot the time. As soon as we realised what time it was, we started making our way up the hill. There was no roads down to the Sea of Galilee. You just went down the hillside, you know. And we scrambled up the hill, and we just got to the top where there is a metallic road that runs from the hotel down into Tiberius, old town. And as we got to the top of this, we was roughly about, well, 30, 40 yards from our hotel. And a bullet whipped over the head. And I thought it was one of the boys acting daft, you know. They got a rifle and bullet, rifle and ammunition, and were acting daft with it. And I hit the deck and Eddie hit it. And it was a choice who had the biggest gravel rash on his nose, me or him. It was really hitting the ground. And just the one shot, and then we could hear shots in the distance. And I lifted my head up, and then another shot came over. And as I looked up, we could see one of the battalion 1500 weights coming down the hill. And then it was followed by one or two more. And as they came over, they was firing from either side of the hill at the wagon. And then a bugler that was on duty sounded the call to arms. And the lads were running out from the Elizabethan and the Central Hotel. And from where we were, we could watch all the action as it was going on up the hill. And it was, well, I would say about 20, 25 minute action. You know, there was lads running up there in the nuddy. Some had got just underpants on, long johns, football pants, whatever, you know. And they were running up there with the rifles and a bandolier of ammunition slung around the necks, fighting the wogs. Which was, to me, now, in those days, I thought was brave. Today, I think was stupid, because they made themselves a beautiful target, you know. But they didn't think, you know, never thought about it in those days. You just went in, muck or nettles. And because of that, I went back to the hotel, and because of that, the army then issued a notice that any civilians, Jewish civilians, that is, would be escorted in and out of Tiberias, from where we were, from the cinema, which was at the back of us, the Jewish cinema, we would escort them into Tiberias town, or anybody wanted to come through with him, take them up, or further on than us was a hospital, so we would escort them up there. Consequently, we was pushed for men, same as the Bobbies are of today, we was pushed for men then. So the boys who were old enough, I was one of them, I was 17 and a half by then, we were given a rifle and a 5 rounds of ammunition. We wasn't given a bandolier. We was given 5 rounds and allowed to escort the civilians. We'd had training. The CO knew. We all knew what rifles were about. We'd all trained with them. We'd all done firing on the range, you know. So he knew which lads he could trust. And we were given bandoliers, 5 rounds and a rifle. And it only lasted for a short while. I mean, after, what, 3 or 4 days, the emergency was over. So you handed your rifle back in, you handed the ammunition back in. And then
what were you doing in that time, though?
Just blowing a bugle and band practice. But I'll tell you one thing that happened there. It's in the book that I wrote. You know, in any group, where there's groups together, a guy has a birthday, especially in the army, and you have a piss-up. Well, this one was a 21st birthday, and it was being held at the Elizabethan Hotel, which was below us. And everybody knew that boys weren't allowed out after 8 o'clock. So they were then asked, will you do this for me, will you do that for me, you know, while you sat there. So I was asked by the duty signaller, a fellow called Trapper Turner, if I would look after the lamp for him while he went to this 21st birthday party. So we agreed. And as you know, in Palestine, the roofs are all flat. And on top of the Central Hotel was a whacking great flat roof. And in the centre of it was the Aztecs and the lamp and heliograph. Everything was up there. So he took me up there and showed me in, what, 10 minutes, what it had taken him 2 years to learn. I didn't know Morse code. I didn't know anything about it. But he showed me how to operate the lamp and how to send the word Monkey Enak, which was our Manchester Regiment call, MNA. Queen was wait. and tea, I think, tok, was an acceptance. Oh, it's yes, that's right. So that was my full training in signals. And this particular night, I can remember it was round about April, May. It was one of them balmy nights, beautiful nights. And I was sat up there looking over the Sea of Galilee. And over the other side of the Sea of Galilee is a place that we used to call Angib. It's now called Angieb. It's a holiday resort, apparently. But that then was a Jewish settlement that was just beginning to build up. And they were equipped with radio, so that if anything happened, and telephone, if anything happened, they would contact the army. It was either us or the Middlesex, which was further over. And this particular night, I was sat on there and I was watching over the Sea of Galilee, not taking any particular notice. As far as I was concerned, I was thinking about the Bible and this, that and the other, you know. And it just started going dusk, well, it had gone dusk, actually. And Angib started signalling with a lamp. Well, in those days, even I knew that they got a telephone and a radio. So I thought, well, it's somebody acting bloody daft. So I took the notice, and the flash was going past me. It was going up into the hills. And then I wondered, could it be the rebels? And I thought, no, they don't go to that extreme, rebels. You know, they don't flash messages. And so I just put a tea on the lamp. You know, I switched it on, put a tea. And their lamp swung straight onto me then and started flashing this message. Now, whether it was coming in English or, you know, Jewish or what, it was Morse code, and I couldn't understand a bloody word of it.
So the tea meant that you were receiving it?
I'd put tea to say that I was ready to receive. So I then sent Monkey Enak, which was our code sign, the Manchester Regiment call sign, and then Queen Wait. And then I dashed downstairs. And there's a young lad down there, a fella called Seabrook. He was a signalman. Mike Seabrook. And I told him what was happening. And he said, oh, I'll go up there and see if I can get Trapper Turner. Even though he was a signalman, it was nothing to do with him. It was a duty signalman to do it. So he goes up to the Elizabethan. And I went back upstairs. Signalling's going on, so I send again, Queen Wait. Then I sent Monkey, and I don't know where I sent. I just sent. And at finishing up, the thing switched off me and went back up into the hills again. So presumably there was another unit up there. And they started signalling there, and then everything went dead. In the meantime, it's around about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. All the lads had this up. They were all drunk. All you could hear was snoring, grunting and groaning. So I reported it to the guard commander. I'd reported to him previous, and he said, oh, forget it. But I reported it to him again. And forget it. Go and have a good night's sleep.